Sports Day for Kia. The Kia Sorento, Drive Car of the Year. And Red Energy, awarded Canstar's most trusted energy retailer nationally for 2021. That's Red Energy.
Good evening, folks. Welcome to a Monday night edition of Sports Day. Jared and Sam have the night off, so Shane McGuinness with you for the next hour. Matthew Lloyd to join me in just a moment, but what an afternoon in Sydney. Collingwood defeating the Demons by 17 points, and Nathan Buckley farewelling the Magpies with back-to-back wins. It was a remarkable performance, and both Melbourne and Collingwood fans, we invite you to come and join us. 13 13 32 is the number. 13 13 32. Maybe it's not all doom and gloom for the Pies. And D's fans, are there just starting to be a few chinks in the armour? 13 13 32, keen to hear from you. Shortly, we'll also go inside the Collingwood rooms as well. However, there is massive breaking news in the AFL when it comes to the round 14 fixture. There was hope that there would be games in Melbourne next week. We had our fingers crossed. We thought finally crowds would be back in Melbourne. Bad news. They're not. There will be no crowds and Melbourne matches next week. In fact, both matches scheduled to be in Melbourne at Marvel Stadium and at the MCG have been moved to Tasmania. What about Geelong, you ask? Well, Geelong and the Western Bulldogs will go ahead at Simmons Stadium in Geelong. However, there will be no crowd at that match. I should say GMHBA Stadium. So, just to recap, no crowds at Melbourne games next weekend. North Melbourne and Brisbane will be moved from Marvel Stadium down to Blundstone Arena in Hobart. Hawthorn and Essendon on the Sunday, 3:20 game, will no longer be played at the MCG. It will now be played at UTAS Stadium in Launceston in front of a crowd. And Friday night's blockbuster, Geelong and the Western Bulldogs. Remember, this is regional Victoria where they've had no coronavirus cases. There will be no crowd at GMHBA Stadium on Friday night. There's another big story. It involves David McKay. I'll get to that in a moment. But first, Matthew Lloyd is here. Lloydie, welcome to you. What a day, not only just of football, but also of news with regards to the fixture and David McKay.
Yeah, it's been a big on-field and off-field change. So remarkable scenes there. Emotional scenes, actually, for me, not even being a Collingwood person, but watching Nathan Bay. He's just a class act. So obviously that was the story on-field, Melbourne being beaten like they did to a hungry Collingwood side. But yeah, the big news off-field, I thought McKay was quite big, but this news, yeah, just shows the world we're living in at the moment with COVID and obviously no crowds again for another week. And big chance for Tasmania. Only 3,300 people there for North and the Giants, but you'd think they'd fill both of those games in Tassie.
It's a significant change to what we were led to believe 24 hours ago, whereby we thought that coming in, all right, the AFL wanted 50%. Maybe that was overs. But you thought 25% at the MCG, that's still 25,000 for Hawthorn and Essendon, 12,500 at Marvel for a game, no offence, North Melbourne, but they do get smaller attendances, so 12,500 for North Melbourne and Brisbane. Then all of a sudden we have the rug pulled out, no footy in Melbourne. And I've got to admit, Lloydie, I find it bewildering that in regional Victoria, of which Geelong is, Geelong and the Western Bulldogs will be played in front of no one.
Yeah, my brother's had a footy there and I was talking to him last week. He said, oh, my kids are living, they're doing their sport, yep. They're living normally, they're at school and all those sorts of things. So so it's just, what's the reason for that, Shane? Is there a reason for particularly the Friday night game in Geelong, why we couldn't at least had 50% just to start off and build up from there? Is there anything around that, extra news in that?
I'm just reading from a media release, and this has literally just come off the presses from the AFL. Geelong and the Western Bulldogs will continue to be played at GMHBA Stadium with no crowds as per current Victorian government advice. This decision to continue to play this match at GMHBA Stadium was made in consultation with the home team and was in line with their preference not to move the game. You can understand that from a Geelong point of view, given how close the eight is. You don't want to have to travel. You want to play at home. I find that incredibly odd that they can't have a crowd, even without Melbourne fans being able to go down the highway. Mm. I mean, you've got a heap of Geelong fans and even Western Bulldogs fans coming from regional Victoria. They'd easily get 25 to 50% crowds there.
Yeah, and we're getting to a point, obviously, you know, for say like a team like Richmond who's been on the road for 3 weeks, at least clubs like Essendon, I suppose Hawthorn were up in Sydney, get back, say finally we can get back to Melbourne. Suddenly you're heading back to Tasmania. So I reckon last year players, you know, thought they were going for 30 days, ends up being 100. I reckon there's going to be, yeah, we see Seb Ross and Tim Membry come back, not play. I just wonder if we're going to, if it drags on for too much longer, I reckon we'll see a lot more players decide, you know, that's not for them to keep being away and on the road from their families.
And I think players, as you say, just not just Tim Membry and Seb Ross, but already expressing, I'm happy to go away for a couple of weeks, but we've got to get home. And I think most would have been pretty hopeful that they would have seen footy back in Melbourne this week. We'll take your calls in a moment. 96900 693 1313 32. So that's one of the big stories of the day, Lloydie. We've touched on Collingwood. That's a massive story today. The other involves David McKay and his bump on Hunter Clark. Now, just give me a moment to try and surmise what the AFL has done today. Last night, the AFL said the notice of charge had been referred directly to the tribunal, that the incident was ungraded. Well, 24 hours makes a pretty big difference, because now the AFL says it will argue that, and I'm quoting here, regardless of whether McKay was contesting the ball, bumping the player, or both, he still contravened the general prohibition on unreasonable conduct, including in contesting the ball. Now, the AFL will further contend that there was high contact and that the impact was severe, and that under tribunal guidelines should result in a minimum 3-game suspension. So, Lloydie, the AFL has not only changed its assessment less than 24 hours later, it's also effectively said it doesn't matter if you're contesting the ball, if you make unreasonable contact with an opponent, you're responsible. And it feels like last night's grenade from the AFL has almost gone nuclear this afternoon. And you almost have to feel for David McKay, because it feels like his legal team now has to defend something he and other players felt was legal going into this past weekend.
Yeah, just to read something like that where, you know, regardless of if he was contesting the ball, I don't know what that's supposed to mean. What else do they want David McKay to do in that sense? Steve Hockey may as well just come out and say, if you enter a contest and you hurt a player, you're gone. You may as well change the rule to that. Doesn't matter if it was accidental or not, because I'm still sitting here and saying, the Byron Pickett days are over. Michael Long on grand final day in 2000, he just pulverised Troy Simmons, could have broken his neck. All those days we saw Wicks on hit Will Day on Friday. Straight away, that's just how you can break a player's neck. That must go. But when David McKay just, I don't know what else he was meant to do. He committed to the contest. It was accidental. Yes, the player has a broken jaw. He contested the ball, though. So I think it'll be more, in my mind, when the tribunal gives him nothing, where Steve Hocking's going from here and what he's trying to get to.
So, and your argument is pertinent. The fact that it seems as though the AFL, in protecting the head trauma and concussion, wants this kind of action of David McKay to be outlawed, not to be there. However, how is that fair on David McKay when, coming into this weekend, he was under the impression that as long as I contest the ball, all's fair in love and war? Yeah. So is it almost a case of, all right, McKay gets cleared here, then Steve Hocking has to come out and go, all right, there is a new rule book now. There is a new precedent that if you go in to contest the ball, but you still make high contact and make unreasonable contact, you're gone no matter what.
Yeah, the first part where you said high contact, if he says, even if you're contesting the ball and you make high contact, you got sure he asked me before, he goes, what if they both go in similarly, Hunter Clark, because Hunter Clark led with his head. McKay did what I would be teaching young players, protect yourself and turn. Lockie Plowman's I thought was okay, but I the angle of he didn't put a fist out to try and spoil, that goes against him. I thought he did a lot right, but he didn't put his fist out, so that went against him. In the McKay sense, he sort of turns to get protect, and they hit the ball at the same time, so I'm not so much, and I was talking to Kane Corns about Dave McKay, and he said he's been criticised in Adelaide for a long, long time, for over a decade, for not being hard enough at the footy. So do we want him to sort of be hesitant? And then Hunter Clark wins the footy, dances around him, and you go, gee, what's Dave McKay doing? So you've got to commit. You've got to commit. And I don't think he was reckless in his attempt to win the ball. I thought he did, couldn't have done much else, and yeah, I don't think he goes for this.
The fact that, you're right, he's gone hard at the contest. Yeah. He hasn't shirked it. If he decided to pull up, because he was running in at speed, if he decided to pull up and just let Hunter Clark get it, then every analyst in the game is going to be, David McKay's weak.
Yeah.
That you can't be doing that. That's an insipid effort. Instead, he's now looking at three games out of the game.
Yeah, and he committed and did the right thing. You know, he didn't commit and just say, I'm going to take Hunter Clark out. He committed. The ball was there. Yeah, he protected himself just to turn his body. And it was an accidental head knock, which caused a broken jaw. Serious injury. We feel for Hunter Clark. But I'm not sure what else Dave McKay could have done in that situation.
13-13-32 is the number. Come and join us, whether it is about the rescheduling of matches for round 14. Hawthorn and Essendon, North Melbourne and Brisbane, no longer in Melbourne. Both moved down to Tasmania. Geelong and the Western Bulldogs still to be played at GMHBA Stadium on Friday night, but no longer in front of a crowd. There will be no one in attendance. Give us a call on the David McKay instance. How do you see it? Do you think it changes the fabric of the game? Is it good that we're trying to get these head-high knocks out? And then it comes down to Collingwood and Melbourne. Lloydie, I mentioned in my intro, just as you were coming in from the broadcast with 3AW, great call this afternoon. Are we starting to all of a sudden see a couple of chinks in Melbourne's armour? Two wins, two losses from the last 4 weeks. They go down to a side, Collingwood, that seemed down and out. Their coach is leaving, for goodness sake. And yet they go down today, the Demons. And then conversely, Collingwood, are they necessarily as bad as everyone thought? And is it all doom and gloom?
Collingwood have got a lot of guys under 10 games, so they'd be excited about that, Shane. But I'm not ready to go there with Melbourne. What Simon Goodwin want to talk to him about is their starts. So I think that they've been poor against Brisbane, got out of jail. Obviously poor today to start. Didn't get out of jail. And the week before against Adelaide, they came back hard but got done in the end. So they've got to sort that out. But I reckon you can't be up for 22, 23 weeks. Even in the year 2000, one of the most dominant sides that we ever saw in Essendon, we fell into a bit of a hole. But we were four games clear on top. And so just naturally, you drop off slightly. And I reckon Melbourne, they're going fine. But I reckon a few teams are starting to lower their eyes, going inside 50, not bombing it long. So we're watching Melbourne more and more, and we're finding ways that you can beat them. And I thought Collingwood planned really well. They didn't get caught kicking it long and high. They were measured with their ball movement, and they got the points. It was a ripper win. Their pressure was outstanding today, Collingwood.
Yeah, what a way for Nathan Buckley to go out and Robert Harvey to take the helm from round 14 onwards. We'll take a break on Sports Day. Your calls on the other side, but hoping to go inside the Collingwood rooms too after that wonderful win over Melbourne today by 17 points at the SCG. You're listening to a Monday night edition of Sports Day.
Ball's on its way, if it holds its line, it's going to hold its line. Now it's difficult for Melbourne. Pendlebury goals.
And Sidebottom will go back and line them up. Sidebottom's lining up the shot for goal after the siren. Collingwood lead by 11. And he makes it 17. What a way to finish.
Sports Day on this Monday evening. Shane McGuinness alongside Matthew Lloyd, Jared and Sam back with you from 6 tomorrow night. What a win it was for Collingwood this afternoon. Nathan Buckley's 478th as a player and coach with the Collingwood Football Club. He goes out with a win, the captain of the Collingwood Footy Club. Kind enough to join us from inside the SCG. I speak of none other than Scott Pendlebury. Scott, congratulations on the win tonight. I can only imagine, though, mixed emotions. Great to have a win, but also farewelling a great of the club.
Yeah, it definitely is. It was, even, you know, the other day, it was since we all found out, it has been a little bit of a weird week, and we sort of acknowledge that and, you know, trying to go through your normal team meetings and preparation and knowing that every day for Bucks was his last time doing something as a coach, it was extremely different. But, I felt like we built on the back of last week's win. We defended really well. It was a great win. It really was great to send Bucks off like that.
Scotty, congratulations today on your game as well. You were absolutely brilliant. I saw you when you were door-stopped at the club and you said, I'm numb, or there was a bit of shock I could sense when you just heard the news. How are you feeling now, and did Buck speak to you guys after the game?
I suppose how I'm feeling now is I'm pretty buggered after a game. And as I said, it's probably really a good thing that we're up here in Sydney, that we get to spend a bit more time with Buck. And I think it will... Yeah, look, I've never been through it, but I feel like it will be a little bit weird tomorrow when we go into the club and he's not there, his office, and you look in, he's not in his office, the guy that you sort of look at and you know he's been here for 10 years, he's been here basically my whole career as assistant coach, or first office player, assistant coach. So, we've moved forward obviously now, and he'll be on the outside looking in, and he spoke about that just before, that he's going to support us. He's, you know, now he's a supporter and he's going to be looking in and wishes us all the best.
I know you've got ambitions to coach, haven't you, after footy?
Well, I don't know if I do after this week.
What would you take away from Nathan Buckley? Say, for example, if you do coach your own team one day, what is some traits of Nathan that you'd take away?
I think, I spoke to Buck about this week. The trait for me is his ability every day to come in and get to work and stay true to himself and his beliefs. His character is first class. And even through this week, how he handled it with the club, he's always putting other people first. And that is the quality of a champion.
Fantastic. The last 2 weeks, Scotty, I know the criticism's come on the club in the way you've played your footy in terms of always been in games, but going laterally. I saw there was a pass to you from Johnny Noble straight down the corridor, and then you hit Darcy Cameron magnificently well. Was that adjusted a little bit, slightly at all, over the last 2 weeks to start to take those options?
I think they've been there, the options. I think our skill execution is just improving. And no doubt it's taken too long to improve and to get to the level. I feel like the last month, really, we've been building against Port Adelaide, lost by a point. The Cats, who were playing really good footy, lost by 10 points. And then to get over the line last week was really important. And I think, too, the element that never gets spoken about is, when you're sitting at 2-9, your confidence isn't high. And you can't just, walk into the kitchen and have a drink with confidence. You've got to action it. And I feel like last week gave us a bit of confidence. Tonight will give us confidence going to the bye and then come out of the bye and see how we go.
Now you're 4-9. Does things change for you of what you could achieve? Obviously not to play finals. You're too far out of it. But what's the last 2 weeks done for you to say now what could potentially happen for the rest of this season?
Yeah, well, I think for us it's just we just want to keep building on what we're doing. I thought out there tonight was I think we have 30 scoring shots against probably the number one ranked defense in the game or if not top four. So. Just that to play a brand of footy like that is very exciting. It's nice to play and you feel like you're going to be dangerous. So if we can keep, trying to deliver that'd be fantastic, but just keep taking the next step.
Scott, does a win like that, especially for a relatively young group, bring in confidence going into the back end of the year? You've got the bye next week that you can almost reset and go, hold on, we can match it with the best in the competition. I'm thinking of players like McCreary, Poulter, Lynch, those that may not have had the success that you've had previously in your career.
I don't think it's been an issue of matching it with the best. I think it's understanding what the game requires and backing the skill and, even walking off with Poults, he was filthy on himself for missing a couple of easy snaps that he thought he should have kicked. And I said to him, that's speed of the game. You'll get used to that. So I think in the back half of the year, when you see our young guys, I think that will just come. Game one to game 12 is a big step, and you're starting to get more confidence, and that will happen in the back part of the year. And I feel like as a group, we're starting to get used to each other's tendencies and what we need to do. But in this game, you've got to be able to do it every week. And in the first half of the year, we haven't been able to, but hopefully we can build on that in the second half of the year.
Scotty, where are you going to play for the rest of the year? Because you've been moved around a little bit of late. It's been nice seeing you back in the midfield at times, half back. You've been as clean as ever, but you even kicked a beautiful goal late. So where do you reckon you play under Robert Harvey for the rest of the year?
Yeah, I think it'll be a combination of back and midfield. I sort of got moved forward. I know Bucks spoke about it, but I split my finger open the day before the Sydney game. So, I had a guard on and it was a bit messy. So I think for a few weeks I was forward more out of a sort of an injury that I was trying to carry through. But I think now will be that midfield and half-back role for me.
Do you think that pressure you've applied today on Melbourne, that's as good as you've applied all year on anyone?
Yeah, I think so. And I think their midfielders do give you a chance in terms of, they back their strength to try and take on the tackle. So it was something we focused on. It was trying to take away Petrarca and Oliver, who are very clean. You can tackle them and they'll still get rid of it. So I was trying to tackle them and then cut off the receiver. I thought we were able to maintain the rage in that regard. And eventually, from our tackle pressure, we would get some turnovers and went back and scored.
Scott, congratulations on the win this afternoon. Was thrilling and no doubt warms the cockles of many a Collingwood fan, especially as you farewell Nathan Buckley. Enjoy the evening and thanks for your time on 3RW on Sports Day.
Okay, thanks guys. Appreciate it.
Scott Pendlebury joining us on Sports Day, all with thanks to Red Energy, awarded Canstar's most trusted energy retailer nationally for 2021. That's Red Energy and the Kia Sorento Drive Car of the Year. Just on what he had to say then, Lloydie, in terms of going into the back half of the year, do you think they'll change much under Robert Harvey?
We spoke to Graham Wright pre-game, and he said he was great. He was very honest, and he said, well, I've already spoken to Robert. There's probably a few little things he'd like to do, but you can't change a game plan in a week. So it'll be pretty similar. He might have different players. He wants to play in different roles. Give Robert a few wins of what he wants to do, but the game plan won't change too drastically.
Your call's coming up. We've got a Spinal Ease pillow to give away. Visit spinalease.com.au. A magnificent pillow for our best caller, 13 13 32. Your call's next on Sports Day. News from the match review officer. Shane Mumford from the Giants has been charged with misconduct against Taron Thomas during the second quarter of their match yesterday. In summary, he can accept a $1,000 sanction, a little bit different to what David McKay is facing. He will face the tribunal on Thursday night. The AFL calling for a 3-game ban. Also, if you're just tuning into Sports Day for the first time tonight, the big news this evening surrounding the Round 14 fixture. There was immense hope that we'd have crowds back at the footy this week, even if venues were at 25% capacity. That will not happen. North Melbourne and Brisbane scheduled for Marvel Stadium on Saturday twilight. That has been relocated to Blundstone Arena in Hobart, and Hawthorn and Essendon at the MCG Sunday afternoon. Would have been a ripping game for Melburnians to attend. They won't be now. That's been moved down to UTAS Stadium in Launceston. And if Geelong fans were excited about returning to Cadinia Park, well, you're just going to have to hold your breath a little bit longer, because Geelong up against the Western Bulldogs will still be played at Cadinia Park, but no crowd will be permitted. That despite Geelong obviously being regional Victoria, no coronavirus cases down there, but still no crowd at Cadinia Park. Pretty disappointing if you ask me. Let's get to some of your calls, Matthew. Lloyd alongside me to Patterson's Lake. Chris, thanks for holding.
No worries. How are you going?
Yeah, really well. Go ahead.
I reckon with this new pandemic law that the Andrews government is trying to get in, unfortunately, I don't see any hope for sports or anything doing well in Melbourne again this year.
You've lost faith, Chris, in sport, and I guess a bit of normality returning.
Everything's getting stopped for, you know, less than for one or two cases. Businesses are going down. Sports, the AFL's now screwed. You know, all our games are being sent to interstate or wherever. How are you supposed to see any hope with this bloody government?
Chris, I'm with you on the AFL stuff. I think it's a massive balls up that they do not have crowds at AFL venues this week, even at 25%, Lloydie. That's my take on it.
Yeah, I've been sent. I was hoping this is exciting. A little fixture for my kids' footy, to restart this weekend. So community football, local football, all that as well. Like, it's just everyone needs it. Everyone needs it. So you're right. I'm just seeing devastation amongst the businesses. I just see it like absolutely everywhere. Like all sorts of businesses. So. Yeah, I don't think there's long to go, Shane, where it's just breaking if it hasn't already, it's breaking people by the day.
And I mean, you don't want to get too political on a sports show, Lloydie, but I think people were, willing to accept the lockdown. All right, there are community cases. We need to prevent the spread. Okay, we'll get our head around it again. But then the last few days for cases, everyone's in quarantine at the moment. There's no mystery cases around. It's just, measure after measure after measure, whereby we can't get back to normality. And sports is just such that social outlet. It's that physical outlet. It's what we love. We were deprived of it last year, and we're being deprived of it again.
Yeah, and then you've got speaking to a coach in Sydney, a mate of mine. He said, "Oh, we're living normally, and our government just handles it differently, but they're living like normal and things they're just getting on with it." So, I think that's what we need to do right now.
Chris, thanks for the call to Kilsyth. Evening to you, Paul.
Hey, boys. How you going?
Really good.
That's the story, mate. No, I've got 2 points. First point is congratulations to Nathan Buckley. What a way to go out. I mean, that's just fantastic. Okay. And my second point is on the hit on Hunter Clark. As far as adjudication, it should be called reckless. And the definition of reckless is heedless of danger or the consequences of one's actions. He knew what he was doing. I know that it's a game that we love to play, but you need to, in today's day and age, you need to toe the line. And he hit him, and he took him out, and he broke his jaw, and he has to suffer the consequences.
When you say you knew what he was doing, what do you mean by that?
Because he knew when he was going in for the hit.
I think he's going in to shield himself. Well,
he had his eyes on the ball. Yes, I agree with that.
Yeah.
But he knew that if he didn't get the ball, he was going to hurt.
I just don't think you want to see players lead with their head. And I saw there was a situation where I'm trying to think of the Mansell against Joel Selwood. So Mansell led with his head. Joel Selwood, after years of experience, turned his body. And they asked Damien Hardwick about it. And Damien Hardwick said, I'm disappointed Mansell went that way. I want him to watch that and say, I'll never, ever lead. He goes, it might be a thing of COVID. We haven't put the time into them like we would have liked to. But he said, my player needs to learn that he can't go for balls like that. And I think Dave Mackay did what you'd teach young players to do. Otherwise, they're both going to lead with their heads and both be hurt.
The problem is, going into this past weekend, what Mackay thought he was doing was the right thing. He thought he was attacking that football with vigour. He had his hands on the football when the unfortunate collision occurred. He thought he was doing the right thing. However, it seems as though the AFL is changing the narrative to say that that is no longer the right thing. But I don't think David Mackay should have to pay the penalty for the fact the AFL wants to change the narrative this weekend.
And I think that we're going to continually, because it's football, there's always going to be head knocks. There's always going to be clashes. So I want Steve Hocking to come out and say, you know what, any head clash, any that creates a serious injury, you are gone. And I just think that it's brought upon more confusion with what's going on.
No, 100% concur. And the onus is on Steve Hocking to come out and say, what is the actual rule around head-high contact? And make it clear, not only for the players and coaches, but just as importantly for the fans as well. Cathy, we're going to come to you in a moment. Also, St Kilda fans, what on earth happened the other night in Cairns? We'll find out from Lloydie next, with thanks to McDonald's. You're listening to Sports Day.
Matthew Lloyd for McDonald's. The new McCafe blend. Coffee fit for an Aussie.
Lloydie, I want to ask you about St Kilda. Before we do that, let's head out to Cheltenham. Evening to you, Cathy.
Good evening. Congratulations to Bucks and his two boys. I thought that was fantastic. And congratulations to our captain. We were in two minds because I couldn't even sing the song. I lost my brother-in-law with brain cancer and he followed Melbourne, but we were still very happy that Collingwood won for Buckley.
Oh, that's lovely. That's lovely, Cathy. That's what footy is all about. There's a nice sentiment there, Cathy, and I appreciate you sharing that with us. I was talking to some Collingwood fans the other day, Lloydie, and they said, you know what, let's say Bucks was to get a job at Carlton. Let's say David Teesnell. Next year, Bucks goes to Carlton. They wouldn't begrudge him winning a premiership at all. Mm. That's just how they feel about Bucks.
Yeah, and it's been so rare. It's such a rare way to go out of it. You know, it ends pretty bitterly for most people.
Yeah.
So for Nathan to go out, it's been done with class from Collingwood's end, I think, and from Nathan's end. And so he'll be a Collingwood person forever. It's great that he's not leaving bitter. And they've just had an open and honest conversation that Graham Wright said, this is a 3 to 5 year build. Nathan, we don't think you're going to be the one to lead that build. Nathan said, okay, I understand that. That's your decision. But he hasn't been bitter about it. And he might take a year off. And if he has a passion for coaching, the way he's gone out and the person that he is, it'll be interesting to see if clubs come calling in about 12 months' time.
Would not be surprised at all if he was to be one of our colleagues in the media next year. Yeah. He did it back in 2008.
Yeah, he's very good.
As a stopgap. Wouldn't be surprised if he did that again next year in 2022. I've got to ask you about St Kilda. I did the match at the weekend. A capitulation as big as I've seen this year, probably only second to West Coast against Geelong down at Cadinia Park. They were all over them early. That second half was just pitiful. I saw you on the Sunday Footy Show yesterday. Carlton's having a review. Is it time for one at St Kilda?
Yeah, I raised that to get to the bottom of how things have turned so badly. I know they've got a lot of injuries and key players out, but so have other teams. And yeah, it's the way they're losing. Yeah, I saw them against Richmond. They were in the game for a period and they end up losing by 80 points. You know, so they're just rolling over. The Essendon loss was just an absolute belting. So Port Adelaide, it's the way they're losing. It would be really concerning. It's the lack of, I suppose, development coming through. I'd look at the way they've recruited. Did they get that wrong? So, yeah, it's from winning a final against the Western Bulldogs last year to where they currently are at. Yeah, I think the hard questions need to be asked.
Then there's Richmond. Thrilling match out west last night. They lead by as much as 22 points midway through the final quarter. Eagles kick the final four goals of the match to steal it away. Richmond, after their win against the Western Bulldogs, we were told, watch out the Wounded Tiger. You know, they are still the team to beat. You look at the stats, though. They've only beaten one team inside the top eight. They've played each of the other seven teams inside the top eight. The only one they've beaten is the Western Bulldogs.
Yeah, it is concerning. The only thing I'd say is I don't reckon there's, after Melbourne today, you'd say, okay, everyone's having a few lapses here or there. For Richmond, they've got three winnable games. They've got St Kilda, Collingwood, and one other side in the next 3 weeks before they face Brisbane and Geelong. And Gold Coast, yeah. So what is it, St Kilda, Gold Coast, and Collingwood?
Collingwood and Brisbane, yeah.
Yeah, so it's a good 3 weeks for them. It was such a hostile environment, and to lose by a kick or so, they didn't lose many admirers. So I think they're still playing okay. They're just not playing well enough for four quarters. They can't get consistency. If they get Tom Lynch back, Dion Prestia back in the team, plus a few others, they'll have to do it from outside the top eight this year for the first time, but I still think they're in the mix.
So let me ask you, before we take a break, I know your top seven's coming up. Melbourne showed they're vulnerable today. The Western Bulldogs have looked shaky at times. Geelong, for mine, are just sitting very pretty at the moment. Who's the premiership favourite for you at the midway point of this season?
That's a great question, Shane. I'll say, it was Melbourne. It was Melbourne right up until today.
Yep.
So I won't jump off them just yet. I'll look forward to seeing who have they got next week, Shane. You got that in front of you?
I think
Melbourne?
They've got the bye next week, the Demons. So bye next week. Blockbuster the week after. Essendon on a Saturday night at the MCG, fingers crossed, and then the Giants at the MCG.
Yeah. But, yeah, so the worry for me is Melbourne's forward line. Obviously, Tom McDonald, Bailey Fritch, can you trust them? Spargo, those sort of players. So, yeah, I'll still say Melbourne just in front of Geelong.
Seems wide open for me. Your top seven right after this.
Matthew Lloyd's top seven for Kia's Sorento, drive car of the year.
All right, Lloydie, time for your top seven. Tell you what, an AFL club president has gone absolutely bang on Twitter. I'll get to that in a moment, but what have you got for us this week?
I've gone, Shano, top seven impact players. So not necessarily the best. Some of them are some of our best players, but impact players who can turn it on in the space of minutes and change the game. And it gave me the idea. He's not in it because he doesn't do it enough, but Jordan Dugowie gave me the idea. Okay, with what
he
did.
So he gave him the idea and he doesn't even make
the
top.
He doesn't do it enough. He can do it, but doesn't do it enough. So number seven, I've got Flying Ryan, Liam Ryan, who can change the game very, very well with his marks and his goals. Number six, this guy is the difference between whether Geelong wins it or not. I think Jeremy Cameron. So Jeremy Cameron in big games has been very, very special.
That's a bit of pressure. Yeah, whether they win it or not is all on Jeremy Cameron.
They've shown they haven't been good enough, just haven't been quite good enough. And Jeremy could be the difference. Five, again, Toby Green. Whether they win or lose often depends on Toby Green. Number four, Nick Natanui. His last quarter was huge and I thought was the difference getting over the line against Richmond. Three, couldn't do it today, but Christian Petrarca has shown over the course of 18 months that he's a game breaker. Number two, Bontempelli. I think he may well win the Brownlow this year, but
I'm surprised he's number two.
Number one, when you win three Norm Smiths, he is the ultimate big game player, Dustin Martin. So he's my number one impact player. Not necessarily the best player. I think Bont's currently the best player at the moment, but Dusty's the biggest impact
Essendon
player.
Essendon fans, feel free to jump on Twitter and give it to Lloydie as to why Darcy Parrish didn't make the cut, but we'll talk about that another time. Just want to leave you with this from Jeff Kennett after it was revealed within the last hour that there will be no games in Melbourne next week. North Melbourne, Brisbane, Essendon, Hawthorn both moved to Tasmania, and that Geelong and the Western Bulldogs will be played in front of no crowd next weekend. Jeff Kennett says, who is running Victoria? Clearly not the government. No crowds at AFL matches next week. Look at Sydney today. Why not 25 or 50%? It's absurd. He then goes on to say, here we come, Tassie. Thank you for treating Victorians as adults. The Victorian government clearly hates its citizens, destroys Victoria's most important long weekend by prohibiting those in Melbourne to travel. He is angry. I get the feeling there will be a lot of footy fans tonight echoing similar sentiments. We've got to wait until at least round 15. Fingers crossed, Lloydie, because, again, the longer we have footy outside of Melbourne, members get antsy, clubs get antsy. They depend on this revenue that they didn't get last year.
Yeah, more lost jobs. More lost jobs everywhere. He'll win a lot of support with that tweet. Shaney is spot on.
He will indeed. Let's hope footy's back in round 15. This is Sports Day.
Sports Day for Kia. The Kia Sorento. Drive car of the year. And Red Energy. Awarded Canstar's most trusted energy retailer nationally for 2021. That's Red Energy.
Second hour of Sports Day on this Monday evening. Nice to have your company. The number 13, 13, 32. Well, the big breaking news this evening outside of Collingwood upsetting the ladder leaders Melbourne is the round 14 fixture. There will be no games in Melbourne next week. When we thought that crowds would finally return, North Melbourne and Brisbane, Hawthorn and Essendon have both been relocated to Tasmania. North and Brisbane to Blundstone Arena, Hawthorn and Essendon to Launceston. And then there's Geelong and the Western Bulldogs. There have been no cases of coronavirus in regional Victoria, but Geelong and the Western Bulldogs will remain at GMHBA Stadium, but there will be no crowd in attendance. Jeff Kennett is the president of the Hawthorn Football Club. Jeff, welcome to Sports Day. I appreciate your time at late notice.
That's a pleasure.
Are you as surprised as I am about the AFL's, statement this evening, which I guess in the end comes back to a decision from government?
Well, that's exactly right. It's not the AFL's fault. It's a decision by government. Am I surprised? I shouldn't be, because this government continues to spring things upon its population that I think are just totally unacceptable and not justifiable. On the other hand, for our 10,000 members in Tasmania, the supporters of Essendon, it's wonderful news. And we thank the Tasmanian government for respecting Victorians, unlike our government here. It is a ridiculous decision when you think 100,000 people run around the town every weekend in the open air. We go to supermarkets, we go to grog shops, you can go to brothels, but you can't go to the MCG, which still is an open-air stadium. It's quite obvious that the government has given up governing, and we've now got third-ranking, fourth-ranking bureaucrats in control of the state.
Jeff, the fact that the AFL initially asked for 50% crowds this weekend, many thought that that might be rejected. Okay, understandable. But when it was alluded to the fact that there could be 25% at the MCG and Marvel, that's 25,000 and 12.5 respectively, surely that should have been considered and also honoured, just to get people back to the footy, back to enjoying what they love, and that's the great game of Aussie rules.
Well, that's exactly right. You can't on one hand be calling on the public to return to normality if, on the other hand, you say to them, we don't respect you enough and you can't go and watch a game of football, even if you're wearing masks. I mean, if you want to totally destroy our confidence and our pleasure, tell us to wear masks at the football. But as you say, 100,000 at the MCG, that could be 25,000 supporters. It could be people selling, you know, drinks and food, etc. You can't allow the government to transfer the authority that they should have to third and fourth ranking bureaucrats to tell us what to do, for goodness sake.
Jeff,
it's madness.
Footy clubs have copped a hit in recent weeks with games having to move interstate, and obviously the crowds haven't been what they would have been in Melbourne. What impact does this have to you at Hawthorn, and what impact, without speaking on behalf of Geelong, but what impact would it have on the Cats, the fact that they have to play in at Cadinia Park, regional Victoria, no cases of coronavirus, but in front of no one at Cadinia Park on Friday night?
Well, don't forget, the government has just locked down this long weekend, so those in regional Victoria, those small businesses that rely on this very busy weekend for a lot of their income, the government's closed them down. So I don't think you should be surprised that they're closing opportunities for the people of Geelong as well. Again, it's absolutely unsupportable in terms of any logic argument. I don't understand who's running the state. It ain't the politicians we elected. There's some gnome in there who's got a grip on this government, unlike what's happening in New South Wales, where the Premier there receives advice and weighs that up against the other interests of her community and her businesses, and she has been able to trade throughout the last 18 months. We've just had our fourth lockdown, and now someone is saying, well, we're not able, although you can run around the town, although you can go to supermarkets, although you can go to brothels, you're not going to the MCG. You ought to get the government on the line, and God help us. You know, the Premier's coming back. Coming back to what?
Well, you know as well as I do that the government doesn't appear on many radio stations, let alone this one. I just want to play devil's advocate for a moment, because some people would say, all right, we had to have the lockdown. I understand it. We don't want to have the community transmission. We don't want it to be a long lockdown like we had last year. But this instance whereby there is no crowd at football, it seems to me that sentiment is moving away from the government, that even those who stood with Daniel Andrews and went, all right, we have to have another lockdown, we just have to shut it down, that this is a bridge too far, and this isn't where we ought to be at this point in time, especially when any new cases are already being quarantined.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more, and I think there has been a shift in sentiment, and I hope it continues. Because these things have got to be managed. I suspect it's because the government does not have confidence in its own administration of the virus, and it doesn't have confidence in the people who are so-called advising them. This is surrender. This is the government waving the white flags of surrender and treating us just like chicken fodder. It's unacceptable, absolutely unacceptable. Now, as I say, so Mr. Andrews has been playing the media over recent weeks about him coming back, and we're all meant to embrace him. I wish him good health, of course. I wish everyone good health. But I tell you what, this government has not only failed, it has demonstrably failed, and it continues to fail because it simply doesn't respect the citizens it leads.
Before I let you go, Tony Cochrane, the flamboyant Gold Coast chairman, has said that there's too much doubt in Victoria and the AFL should already be looking at holding the grand final outside of Victoria. Does what has transpired today with matches being moved out of Victoria for round 14 only strengthen his argument that the grand final may not be at the MCG this year?
Well, my advice to Tony, who is, as you say, a very colourful individual, my advice to him would be to speak to the chief health officer, because it's obvious he's the one you've got to speak to here in this state. Forget the Premier. I have the highest regard for James Molino, and I think he's taken a lot of the political heat out of the Andrews legacy that he had to bear on his shoulders. But if I'd been James Molino when I was advised, as I must have been, no crowds at the MCG, I would have said to the chief health officer, that is a step too far. We are going to override that decision, and we're only going to allow 25 or 50% of the audience or the spectators to attend. To Tony Cochrane, speak to the chief health officer.
Just one more on that, Jeff, just before I let you go. As Premier, you obviously had your own chief health officer at that point in time. That role of chief health officer, Am I correct in saying that it is an advisory role only, thus giving advice to the Premier's office and they can take that decision or not? And we know how much medical advice and how many difference of opinions there are from epidemiologists around the country on this at the moment. The CHO role, Chief Health Officer, is it only an advisory role?
Yes, he has no powers over government. And, you know, government takes advice from a whole lot and a whole range of people. In the end, the government have to make decisions. And what you have heard for the last 18 months, the government stands up, we are taking advice from our health officials, etc. They are hiding behind the skirts of our health officials, unlike the Premier of New South Wales, who receives the advice and then makes decisions in the best interest of her community. Our leaders here have failed because they don't have confidence in their own ability, as we saw with the original hotel quarantine debacle, to manage this virus.
How much is this going to cost Hawthorn by moving the game to Launceston?
Well, it's, as I say, it's, It works both ways for us. I don't know what the financial outcome will be. I haven't even put my mind to that. And I'm very pleased for the supporters of North Melbourne and their opponents and our Essendon supporters down there and our members that they'll see two very good games next weekend. And I thank the Premier of Tasmania and the people of Tasmania for allowing us to, as we've had to, move out of our own home state because our government doesn't want us here.
Jeff Kennett, you're always generous with your time. Appreciate it on Sports Day this evening.
Thank you. Have a good night.
Former Premier, now President of the Hawthorn Football Club, Jeff Kennett. Fair to say, you can see where he's coming from. I think he hits the nail on the head. I don't always agree with what he has to say or his views against the government. But I think we've completely and utterly stuffed it up on this one. Footy should be back in Melbourne. Not with 100% crowds, not even 50% crowds. You have 25% at the MCG. That's 25,000. You space them out. That's social distancing at its absolute finest. You're not even going to see social distancing like that in Bourke Street Mall or out at Chadstone. But goodness me, can't even have footy back. More of Sports Day right after this. You're listening to Sports Day. We're here for Red Energy, awarded Canstar's most trusted energy retailer nationally for 2021. That's Red Energy. And of course, right across Tasmania for Wilson Homes. Believe in great design, so you love being home. Well, can you believe it? The Olympic Games are only 30 days away. So I wanted to talk the Olympic Games, and I wanted to talk to this man. He's the author of Olympic Turnaround and a new book called Tune In. We'll talk to him about that in a moment, but he's also a former IOC marketing executive. And given these Tokyo Olympics are going to be very different to more recent games, I wanted to have a chat and find out just what that means for major supporters and broadcasters alike. Michael Payne, thanks so much for your time on Sports Day.
Great to be with you.
Take me through your thoughts on the Tokyo Games, A, going ahead, and B, the importance of them going ahead for the International Olympic Committee in terms of revenue?
Firstly, I think the Games will definitely take place. The Japanese organisers, the government, the IOC have put in place very strict protocols to ensure that they can be a safe and secure Games, with effectively everybody having to be vaccinated before they go to Japan, being tested before they go, being tested every day on the ground, and living in a bubble of the athletes' village and the venues. So the measures that have been put in place are very tough, but I think will ensure that the Games can be staged safely and securely. And then the focus is, you know, to the athletes and making sure that they have their chance on the stage once every 4 years. And the choice after last year's postponement was either the Games take place or they're cancelled. And I think everybody throughout the sports community, even the medical professionals like the World Health Organization, they're now comfortable that the whole process can be properly managed.
We've seen Games called off because of world wars previously. We saw the challenge that was the Zika virus back in 2016 in Rio. But is this the greatest challenge the International Olympic Committee has ever faced?
From an operational standpoint, clearly, the logistics of postponing and then having to sort of reboot everything from the venues to putting in place the medical protocols, I mean, it's operationally mind-boggling. Whether it's the greatest challenge, I mean, when I joined the IOC in the early 80s, we were actually dealing with an existential challenge as to whether the Olympics would even survive. Back then, you know, there was no funding. They were caught in the sort of political crossfire of the sort of Cold War with the boycotts. And many of the commentators at the time were sort of saying, you know, the Olympics had served the 20th century very well, but they'd become too political, too big. And as a result, most people were writing their obituary. So you go back 40 years and you were seriously questioning whether it was the end of the road. Today, as challenging as the operational delivery is, you've got an incredible set of cities lined up for the future, you know, with summer games in Paris, in Los Angeles, and every expectation that the Olympics will be coming to Brisbane in 2032.
Do you think the Olympics will be tarnished at all in Tokyo by the fact that that international spirit won't be as radiated through the city of Tokyo as it was in Rio, London, Athens, Sydney in years previous? It just seems to me the spirit of the Olympics resonates through the host city, and that's going to be absent in Tokyo this time around. Do you think that hurts the games going forward, or does it in a way strengthen them, the fact that, you know, this is just COVID, something that we've had to overcome?
You make a great point, and there's no question that part of the magic of the Olympic Games is this incredible celebration and festival that extends throughout the city and the local people. I wouldn't write the Japanese off just yet. They've always been skeptical in the lead up to the games. Even you go back to 1964 Tokyo, which was a defining moment in Japanese history. Before those games, the Japanese were very nervous. They were saying, oh, I'm not sure, it's too soon, it's too risky. Is this such a good idea? And yet it went on to be incredible games. And the games are first and foremost defined by the incredible sporting performance. And no matter what problems you encounter in the build-up, you mentioned Zika, I mean, and people calling for the cancellation of Rio. 2 years ago for the Winter Games in Pyeongchang, people were calling for the cancellation 2 months before because they were scared that Trump and Kim were going to nuke each other. And yet they went on to deliver great winter sporting performance. So of course, would you prefer the stadiums full with international spectators? But in order to deliver those safe and secure games, some compromises have got to be made. Will there be a long-term negative? Not at all. I think in that sense, you go back to the era of the boycotts, the Olympic movement has faced much tougher challenges relative to its image and brand.
The way we consume sport is ever-changing. Television was always the primary means. Now we're looking at it on our phones and on our iPads, still using TV, but consumption has changed dramatically. We know NBC pays billions for the rights to the Olympic Games. The Seven Network here in Australia pays millions for the rights to the Olympic Games. Have we reached a pinnacle in the value of television rights broadcast? For instance, the next time NBC signs, albeit after 2032, will the IOC still get a similar amount? And even the Seven Network, which has the rights for Beijing next year, but then 2024 is up for grabs. Do you think an Australian broadcaster will be prepared to pay the same as what they did 10 years ago?
Again, you're absolutely right. The world is changing in the way that people consume content. And in particular sport content, that people are wanting it immediately and they're looking at across multiple screens. But the key principle is that everybody still wants to watch and engage, and advertisers want to make that connection as one of the few guaranteed content, entertainment, sport will deliver the eyeballs. So whether it's coming purely from the TV screen or from the iPhone or from screens yet to be identified, what you've got the case, NBC going out so long term, they become the gatekeeper for distributing the content. And interestingly, they announced yesterday that they will be distributing 7,000 hours of content in America. At the 1996 Atlanta Games, they distributed 200 hours. So for the viewer, for the marketeer, there's a whole explosion in new opportunity and ideas. And for the sports fan, it's great because you're able to choose what you want to watch, where you want to watch it, how you want to watch it, in what language you want to watch it. And in particular, the Olympic Games, which has more than 30 different sports, often you were not able to watch your favorite sport because the producer will have deemed that water polo was more important than judo.
I want to ask you about your book because it looks absolutely fantastic. Just before I do, you mentioned Brisbane before, Brisbane in 2032. From an IOC perspective, Rio, the appointment of Rio as a host city was seen as a risk, giving it to a South American host city. They've gone safe with Tokyo, Paris, Los Angeles. Is Brisbane a safe bet as opposed to somewhere like Jakarta, which may pose greater risk to the IOC?
I was very involved with the Rio bid and the early stages of the operational delivery. And when Rio was selected in 2009, it was seen as an inspired choice, taking the Olympic Games to a new continent. Unfortunately, after the nomination of Rio, everything went downhill. And the organizational complexity was not beyond Brazilian business, but within government and more importantly, the leaders of the Rio bid, and I say this sort of somewhat directly, but it's true, were so incompetent that the IOC didn't even know whether the games would make it to the next day. And so as a result, the IOC is out of the risk business, that recognizing that this is so complicated to deliver, not if you do proper disciplined planning, and there are still incredible memories from the success of Sydney, that the IOC wanted to be, shall we say, just a little bit more due diligent in identifying the partners for the future. And it's not to say that, you know, the games will never go to other developing nations, but for the time being, the Rio experience is still a little bit too fresh. And it's not like you're staging I was on the board of Formula One, you know, where you're staging 20 events a year. If for some reason one race doesn't work, it's not the end of the world. You go on to the next race and everybody's forgotten about the problem. It's a little bit harder with the Olympics if it doesn't work, because you've then got a 4-year wait.
Absolutely, you do, as we've even seen with Tokyo having to be delayed by a year. I have to ask you about your new book, because your previous publication, Olympic Turnaround, was a real nuanced look at how sponsorship with the Olympic Games comes about. This new book, Tune In, T-O-O-N-N, is a more fun, enjoyable look at the Olympics, but also, I guess, in a way, poking fun at the Olympic Games. Tell me what inspired you to write this, and just where some of the cartoons have come from, because it is a remarkable collection of Olympic cartoons which really tell the story of so many games.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, yes, it does poke fun, and I think, frankly, after a year and a half lockdown, everybody needs a good laugh. And this was my lockdown project. But I used to collect Olympic cartoons, and I had maybe 50 or 100. And I always thought that it was a great way to look at the Olympics through the social time of the day, through society over the last 100 years. And I thought, well, wouldn't it be interesting to write a history of the Olympics told through the political cartoonist, maybe with a little bit of color as to what was really going on behind the scenes. So I eventually pulled together 1,200 cartoons from some 400 cartoonists around the world, 50 different nationalities, and proceeded to write a very edgy commentary as to what was really going on with many of the stories that have never been told. Some of them are very fun, you know, like, how was the Queen convinced to jump out of the helicopter with James Bond? And did the family really know nothing? I mean, the close friend of mine was sitting next to Prince William and Prince Harry. And as the Queen jumped out, they just looked up and said, "It's Granny." They had no idea that she had very quietly signed up to be a sort of participant in the opening ceremony beyond the formal protocol. You go then to other stories in the book, such as the most recent Pyeongchang Winter Olympic Games, where a group decided to crash the complete technology operations of the games during the opening ceremony, so the games will not take place the next morning or the day after. And the Koreans did an incredible job rebuilding the total technology system overnight. And then the digital detectives started, you know, finding out, well, who was behind this? And all of the evidence, all of the digital footprints over the next year led to North Korea.
Unbelievable.
Except people said, this doesn't make sense. North Korea, Kim, decided that he wanted to come to the games and it was going to be, you know, his new best friend. So who was really behind it? And a group had decided to blame North Korea, not thinking that Kim would ever decide to go and that people would look at the evidence a bit more deeply, until all the fingerprints led back to Moscow, because Moscow had been banned from the games. And if they couldn't go, then nobody else was going to go. So you've got a lot of, for the sports fan or for the historian, a lot of stories, you know, over the last 100 years, and I've been involved very closely for 40 years, so you've got a lot of firsthand stories, which I think might cause a few raised eyebrows, might cause the odd laugh. And it's certainly a very different look at Olympic history.
Michael, what I love is that the cartoons as well that have been collected, so many of them irreverent, and just even your story then, the Olympic Games are so much more than what happens within stadiums and in swimming pools, and that's personally what I love about the Olympics. They are just this incredible, all-encompassing story, this social conglomerate that comes together once every 4 years. The book is called Tune In by yourself, Michael Payne. You can jump online. OlympicCartoon.com is the website to go to. It explains more about the book, how you can order it as well. Anyone with any interest in the Olympic Games and just wanting to find out more, some of the secrets behind the scenes, it is the publication to get in 2021. Michael, wonderful to chat. Let's hope we can talk maybe a little bit closer to the Tokyo Olympics even after and get your thoughts on just how the games went. It all goes ahead, starts in 30 days. Thanks so much for your time on Sports Day.
My pleasure, and look forward to talking to you again. I will be in Tokyo.
Wonderful. Enjoy it. Michael Payne, I've got to admit, I'm a little bit jealous that he is going to be there. More of Sports Day right after this. Great to have your company on this Monday night edition of Sports Day. Shane McGuinness in for Jared Healy and Sam McClure. Well, the French Open came to an incredible conclusion last night. Stefanos Tsitsipas and Novak Djokovic. Tsitsipas taking the first two sets. You thought, hello, changing of the guard. And then Novak did what Novak does best. Won the next three sets. Wins his 19th Grand Slam title. Just one behind the 20 of Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal. To talk a little bit of tennis, a man who was in Paris for the French Open, back in London now, is Robbie Koning. You'd be familiar with his work. We hear it in Australia via the World Feed. Robbie, lovely to chat, and thanks for your time.
No problem, Shane. It's been a fantastic 2 weeks, a lot of different storylines. So once again, you know, that guy, Novak Djokovic, as you suggested, doing mind-boggling stuff, Shane.
I find it incredible that he is the first male player to win the Australian Open and French Open since Jim Courier back in 1992. The big question is, can he be the first player since Rod Laver to win all four in a calendar year?
Well, obviously, he can be the only one this year. There's no question that he has got the ability. I think going into Wimbledon and the US Open, he'll be the odds-on favourite. We know how well he plays on the lawns of the All England Club. I think he's won five times there, and he loves the hard courts. I think if it all goes down to the US Open, you know, given his record on a hard court, it's hard to see anybody beating him. But, you know, that's why we lace him up. That's sport. But I thought back in 2015, he would have a good shot at doing it. I thought he'd have a really good shot at doing it, given how well he was playing back then, but it wasn't to be. So you just never know. I would love to see him do it. You know, selfishly, in our lifetime, I want to see it, Shane.
Do I dare ask, is Stefanos Tsitsipas the man to break up the top three? We've seen other contenders, Wawrinka, Cilic, just to name a couple, Medvedev. Is Tsitsipas the one to do it?
Yes, I think he is. I think he's got fantastic variety. I think this guy's going to be coming up in the next couple of years. But if you're talking about immediacy, I think him and Zverev are the two guys who have got an enormous amount of belief. You know, they've won Masters 1000s. They've beaten these guys before. And I'm talking about, you know, the top three guys. They've beaten them before. So the belief is there. And perhaps even more so with Tsitsipas. There's a steely resolve about that young man that I think Zverev had when he was bursting on the scene in 17 and 18. But he's just lost a little bit of late. And it's going to take some doing to get it back. But if you were asking for my top pick, it would be Tsitsipas to be the party spoiler.
I've always said the best match of Grand Slam tennis I've ever seen was Djokovic and Nadal in the 2012 Australian Open final, the longest Grand Slam final recorded. There's a chance that Novak and Rafa's match on Friday night in Paris may have surpassed that. Was it one of the best you've ever seen?
Yes, it was one of the best. I don't think it was the best. I think 2012 is a very good shout, given how long that one went on for. I think the quality of it was insane for the duration.
Incredible.
Sorry, carry on, Shane.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, the way that these two are able to keep going, the athleticism. I mean, there's one thing to win a best of three sets match. It's another thing to win a best of five. And for me, that is where the likes of Federer, Djokovic and Nadal have been able to separate themselves. And I mean, you even go back to last night, Tsitsipas wins if it's the best of three sets. But Nadal, Djokovic and Federer, they take it to another level over five.
They do. And you've got to remember that match that we saw between the two was a four-set match. It didn't even go to five sets. But obviously the intensity was insane. The quality of that third set was mind-boggling. And what people don't realize is what these guys can do at the end of their range. They make it look like everything is right there, comfortable and in front of them, but it's anything but. You know, these guys are playing at the extremities of every shot and yet producing what they produce. I thought the 2017 final with Federer and Nadal was unbelievable down in Oz. That was one of my favorite ever to commentate on. You know, when Rafa had gone 3-1 up in the fifth there, we thought, okay, this guy has got Roger again. He's got him. But only for Roger to come back and win the last five games. And that, you know, that 4-3 game was epic. One of the greatest rallies we've ever seen down in Australia. You know, I can remember it in my head, 26 shots. But you're right. These guys keep pushing the envelope. And rather than try and pick out one individual match, let's just drink it all in, Shane. Let's drink it all in because it's not going to be here for many more years, man.
No, we know that. And we especially came to the fore in Melbourne this year, not having Roger Federer out here. I've got to ask you about the women's side of the draw. Barbora Krejcikova and Anastasia Pavlyuchenkova, certainly neither were in people's predictions about making the final, let alone winning it. Do you think they'll continue to fire over the next year, or is the women's draw, as we've seen so much in recent years, going to continue to circle around? And who knows, maybe even Serena Williams can finally get that 24th title.
I think on a hard court, Osaka is going to be very difficult to beat. She's proved that already.
Yeah.
But, you know, as I say that, I think about the fact that she was match point down, two match points down in the round of 16 in Oz. I mean, you know, she could have been out of the tournament. In the round of 16, we wouldn't be speaking much about the fact that she'd won another major title. So, you know, I think in the women's game at the moment, there are so many good players. The depth is so incredible. There's no intimidation. People don't feel intimidated walking on the court, taking on Osaka or taking on Ash or taking on, you know, Muguruza. There's so much belief that they have the level, and that's all you have to have, is you've got to have the level, and we've seen it, so many of the women do. So it's fascinating the way it's going to shake out. I think it's a pity Ash got injured. It's a pity that Simona got injured, because they're going to be looking back thinking, well, you know, maybe this is one that got away from us, given that the finalists were two women that we didn't expect to be there. But if we have a look at somebody like Pavlyuchenkova, what a, you know, storied junior career she had, how good she was when she was younger. It's surprising it's taken her this long. But, you know, just to put that into perspective, she is a lady who is not all consumed by tennis. And maybe that's why it hasn't happened for her. She really does enjoy a good party. She enjoys a good night out. Tennis is not the be-all and end-all of her existence. And she's happy with that, Shane. You know, sometimes we as sports pundits, we expect everybody to be completely focused, like a Novak or like some of the other players that we see in sport are, that are completely committed to their sport. But she's not, and she's okay with that. And, you know, you say that maybe she wishes that after yesterday's match she had been a little bit more committed, because she spoke about her fitness. But you got to take the good with the bad. You know, it's one that it's always a conundrum in my mind, that when that opportunity comes by, are you ready for it? And that yesterday was the difference between the two. Someone like Krejcikova, who was completely committed to the sport, when the opportunity presented itself, she was there to grab it. Pavlyuchenkova wasn't.
Before I let you go, I want to ask you about Naomi Osaka. Obviously, it wasn't the ending to the French Open campaign. People thought it would be. A lot of controversy with her decision not to do press in Paris. French Open organisers have said, had she have continued through the tournament and not done press conferences, she would have continued to be fined. Do you expect that she will change her thinking ahead of going into Wimbledon? Because I would suspect that the All England Club will have a similar ethos to what they did at Roland Garros.
Yes, well, as you suggested, I think all four majors came together, as we saw there, and put out the statement, and they had to stand united. Gilles Moreton, you know, the president of the FFT, was asked about that yesterday before the finals. You know, and he spoke about the athlete's responsibility towards the press. So, you know, I'm hoping, I think Naomi released something yesterday or the day before to say, looks like, you know, things are getting better for her. Sure. I'll be surprised if she doesn't show up at Wimbledon. You know, I just think the messaging was the part that was confusing for everybody. The fact that she didn't alert them, the French Tennis Federation, beforehand. She kind of showed up on site and said, okay, I'm not doing press and I'll take the fine. And then that's when things got a little bit muddy, right? It was like, you know, had her team done their due diligence, excuse me, because they probably thought she could get away with that throughout the duration of the French Open, just pay the fine. But that wasn't the deal, right? The deal was it gets incrementally worse and they can default you. So I don't know whether her team actually knew that was the protocol. And then the story started to change. And I think that's what frustrated a lot of the other athletes on the ground. And certainly the messaging from other athletes is it's part of our sport. We don't like it. We don't like being asked tough questions in post-match interviews. We have to do it. And, you know, I think because it's uncomfortable for Naomi, you know, she chose not to do it. And then the whole mental health issue came in. And obviously it's a very sensitive subject, right, Shane? So, you know, you got to have the kid gloves on when somebody starts to speak about that. Because if it is serious, then she's talked about having, you know, depression post 2018 at the US Open. And I guess my only question was, if that was the case, you know, you know, who she's been speaking to, because that never did come out. Who is your therapist that you've been working with if you have had these problems? And I never heard any conversations about that. So that would have been my first question. Who is your therapist? What is she working through with you? And we never heard any of that. So that was some of the talk that was going on.
Absolutely, Robbie. I couldn't concur anymore. Very generous with your time, as always. Hope to catch up again soon. Robbie Koenig on the line from London, talking tennis. Well, that just about does it for this Monday night edition of Sports Day. Thanks so much for your company. Don't forget, you can download the podcast if you want to rehear any of the interviews that have been on Sports Day over the last couple of hours. It's been a big day of football. Collingwood knocking off Melbourne, the top of the ladder Demons. Nathan Buckley going out in style in his 478th game with the Collingwood Football Club and his last as coach. The ladder, after 13 rounds, Melbourne still sit at the top of the table, but the Dogs could be back there should they win next weekend. Geelong, Brisbane round out the top four. Port Adelaide, Sydney, West Coast, Richmond hanging in eighth position. You've got to think maybe Fremantle, the Giants and Essendon still a chance of jumping into the eight. Other than that, I think it's all locked and loaded. Jared and Sam will be back with you from 6 o'clock tomorrow night. Thanks for your time on Sports Day.